When I drive to Tucson during my winter break, I like to look at all the signs and billboards that are found in the cities that I pass through. Most signs, of course, are ads for businesses and even hospitals. Many are to make sure that you get a good lawyer so that you can sue the person who just hit your car bumper. And others still are religious in nature. In different cities, in fact, I kept seeing one particular sign. It said, "When you die, where will you go?" And on one side of the billboard, it had a nice picture, and it said, "Heaven." And on the other side of the billboard, it had a picture of fire, and it said, "Hell." Now, rather than being fearful or discouraged or concerned about this sign, I started thinking about the mythology surrounding the ideas of heaven and hell, and the history from ancient times that led to these concepts that are so ingrained in conservative religious traditions in this country. That is, rather than being concerned about whether or not I was saved, I found myself engaged in intellectual ruminations. The truth is that the threat of hell, or a worldview in which life is about making sure that I end up in some kind of heaven, does not do anything to or for me. Believe me, though, it once did. As a child growing up in a pretty conservative church, heaven and hell were pretty foremost in my mind. But I have come to believe that the question of salvation is the wrong question about life. Moreover, I have come to believe that humankind's spiritual nature is deeper than that which comes from fear or anxiety. The religious sign on the side of the road that most intrigued me on this trip, however, was something fairly novel. It simply said, "Trust in Jesus." But there was something else about the sign that caught my attention as I was going 65, 70 miles past it. It was the background. There were colors in the background. Kind of abstract, but not entirely. The colors were blue and white and some red. The blue was concentrated in one corner. Got it. It was an abstraction of the American flag. I had just driven by one of the best depictions on a sign that I have ever seen of what sociologists and students of religion call civil religion. Trusting in Jesus and trusting in America go hand in hand. Both are blessed. Both are sacred. Both are holy. Both are chosen. Although it is theologically complex, we know that historically Jesus would be understood as the Messiah and God incarnate among traditional Christians. But how could America be understood as something divine? Every day, they rise to the surface to be seen by the people. Every night, they descend into a vault in order to be protected. The vault is made of steel, and tons of metal surrounding them prevent an accident from occurring. They rest in a special case filled with helium and covered with protective glass to preserve them. They are the original copies of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and they reside in the National Archives Building in Washington, D.C. We Americans have our own scriptures. We have our own holy city. But scriptures in a temple are not sufficient to create a semblance of a religion. There's usually the need to have sacred space, sacred time, sacred saints, creeds, and codes. So for Americans, sacred space includes shrines and holy places like George Washington's home in Mount Vernon, Virginia, and Independence Hall in Philadelphia. The Smithsonian consists of many shrines dedicated to the preservation of sacred history, but is part of the larger Washington, D.C. temple complex. Battlefields, such as Gettysburg, where conflicts loomed prominently, have also become sacred spaces. I visited a little-known Civil War battlefield in New Market, Virginia, this January. The battle occurred in 1864, and the Confederacy was basically forced to fight a defensive war at this point. Desperate for more help as they tried to prevent the North from taking over the Shenandoah Valley, the Southern general summoned the Corps of Cadets from the Virginia Military Institute, several miles down the road from New Market. Of the 257 cadets who fought in the battle, 10 died, 7 of whom were freshmen. To this day, the students at VMI commemorate their fallen heroes every year on May 15th, the anniversary of the battle. This is all about sacred space, sacred time, sacred people. Our calendar, too, is full of sacred time and is part of our civil religion. 4th of July, President's Day, Memorial Day, what used to be called Columbus Day and is now officially Indigenous Peoples Day in Belfast, Thanksgiving, New Year's, and, of course, Super Bowl Sunday. George Washington exemplifies our need for sacred figures. In fact, the religious historian Catherine Albanese writes, "The greatest symbol of the godlike quality of true Americans was George Washington. In the Revolutionary era, people revered him as a divine man. So while he lived, Washington became the center of a cultus. Locks of his hair were treasured. Babies were baptized in honor of him. And legends were circulated about his miraculous abilities as a war leader." By 1779, a German language almanac had already called him the father of his country. Washington was compared by his contemporaries to both Jewish and Roman heroes. He was the Moses of his people, freeing them from slavery in Egypt. Alternately, he was Cincinnatus, the great Roman general who had left his plow to fight for his country and then, when the task was done, dropped the sword to return to his farm. Other figures, of course, would be Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, both of whom had been born on the same day and year, both of whom died the same day and year. In the 19th century, Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln would be granted sainthood. In the South, of course, Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis, I noticed, were prominent as names for sacred places. In the 20th century, Franklin D. Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy come to mind, although in the last couple of presidential elections, I've noticed that Ronald Reagan has often been invoked by at least one of our political parties. And in the 21st century, no one seems to like anybody. These are all manifestations of civil religion. In spite of the plethora of religious groups and denominations in this country, civil religion is the dominant religion. We claim separation of church and state, and yet all our coinage is embedded with the words, "In God we trust." While it's not the case with the other coins, our penny has "In God we trust" at the very top of the penny. So our lowest denomination, our least significant coin, tells us on top what is most important in this country. Trust in God, trust in America. The fact that "In God we trust" is imprinted on coins, on money, says a great deal too about what is being worshipped. Our creed or code, that is our beliefs and how those are manifested, could be said to go back to the Puritans and to those who colonized the Atlantic coast. Puritan New England was a theocracy. Religion and state were one. The Puritans, by the way, are part of our own background as Unitarian Universalists. Our fierce independence as UUs and as New Englanders has many of its roots in Puritan New England. And the Puritans saw themselves as the true chosen people from the almost chosen England. Since the Puritans' creed said that they were chosen and the never-ending fight between good and evil, or God and Satan, then their code had to be twofold. First, the Puritans had to be an example for the entire world. After all, they were the chosen, destined, even predestined, to have elect status and to be the visible saints on earth. As such, righteousness would triumph over the demonic forces in the world. And second, the Puritans had a mission to spread the good news, that is, to make sure the world was living as were they. The Puritans, in other words, were a light to the world, a light that needed to be spread for the good of humankind. This is how God blesses America. It seems to me that our country's creed and code, 400 years after the Puritans arrived, have not changed dramatically. How else do we explain all the wars we have engaged in for four centuries? Call it a war for freedom or democracy, it remains the same. We have a mission. Much of the rhetoric that inflames people around world politics and wars, whether from church pulpits, political demagoguery, or the media, has a Puritan ring to it. We are the chosen. We are the light. By the way, you youths have to be a little careful about this as well. We have a mission. While away this past month, I watched a few of the pre-presidential debates and town meetings leading up to the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. I shouldn't be surprised anymore, but I was disenchanted by how much rhetoric there was about killing, fighting, and the evils of North Korea, Iran, Putin of Russia, and Assad of Syria. Oh, and Obama. I was disheartened by questions relating to the United States maintaining itself as the police force of the world. When will we get it? When will we get that this form of civil religion and our understanding of the nation state are simplistic and obsolete? When will we get that white people are not the chosen? When will we get that any sense of privilege and mission has and continues to lead to slavery, colonialism, and to empire building? When will we get that sending our children to fight or to be killed as a sacrifice for preserving dubious nationalistic values is reprehensible? And from a religious perspective, when will we get that civil religion is a manifestation of idolatry? This, then, is the theological context. Any truly prophetic religion must counter, confront, and challenge any aspect of civil religion that is not self-transcending. Now, I imagine that most of us here today remember having to say the Pledge of Allegiance in public school. Is it right to promote civil religion in public educational institutions? I'll talk to the teachers afterwards. In many Christian churches, there is a Christian flag prominently placed on one side of the pulpit and the American flag on the other side of the pulpit. Is this a form of civil religion? Is it a contradiction? The Jehovah's Witnesses would respond with a resounding yes. For them, the Pledge of Allegiance in school or a flag in a church is a form of idol worship. Now, I have rarely agreed with the idea of the Jehovah's Witness, ideas of Jehovah's Witnesses. But I have to admit that in cases like these, they have made me pause and ponder. And maybe this is something we can discuss further at the congregational conversation after service. For those who might think I have been or am being too political, I would like to suggest that Unitarian Universalism is, in its very essence, a prophetic movement. And a prophetic movement must counter all forms of idolatry. Anything that I say that seems to be political always, always has a deeper theological context. And here's the context. And the words come from one of our own Unitarian theologians and saints, James Luther Adams. He writes, and you might recognize this, "I call that church free, which enters into covenant with the ultimate source of existence, that sustaining and transforming power not made with human hands. It binds together families and generations, protecting against the idolatry of any human claim to absolute truth or authority." So what is it that we actually truly worship? What is it that is truly ultimate? America? American heroes and saints, money, power, ourselves. That which is not the ultimate source of existence, whatever one names it or understands it to be, is about the worship of idols. And one of the difficulties about being a Unitarian Universalist is that we're committed, however difficult it may be, to seeing through anything that smacks of religion but is in fact idolatrous. One thing more. There was a brilliant question by a rabbi at a town meeting in New Hampshire directed to Hillary Clinton. He said something like this. There was a rabbi who said you need two written notes, one to go into each of your two pockets. So one note you put in your pocket and it says, the world was made for me. The other said, I am made of dust and ashes. How do you balance the two? How do you balance ego and humility? Where lies humility? What does it look like for an individual, a people, a country? It is time that we accept that we are not a chosen people. To accept that we Americans are not better than anyone else. What we need to be is a part of the world community, a community that serves one another in order to meet everyone's essential needs, a community that serves, honors, and respects the earth which gives us life, a community where we learn to see the beauty and heart song in every single person and every being, a community that walks the road of compassion and love. May it always be so. And amen.